This call is being recorded by the meeting organizer. By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Good morning. This is Gloria Bradley Brown. I will serve as your facilitator this morning for the annual Perkins Funding Opportunities webinar. A few housekeeping rules. We do have the phone muted, so the process will go as follows. We have several presenters scheduled to review the 2015-2016 funding opportunities information. You can access the request for applications on our website. Hopefully, you're connected to the webinar using the information shown on screen 3. Again, my name is Gloria Bradley Brown, and I'm the Bureau Chief of Grants Administration and Compliance for the Division of Career and Adult Education. To help minimize background noise, please keep your phones on mute while listening to the conference call. The instructions, you may mute your phone by pressing *6. If you would like to unmute your phone, you will also press *6. The process will go as follows. We have several presenters scheduled to present this morning. At the conclusion of their section, I will unmute the phone and allow you an opportunity to ask questions. We also have at the end of all presentations a general question and answer session. Using the webinar process, email us your questions and we will be able to have your questions answered during our webinar, or if we have to follow up with you, we'll follow up with you after the webinar. With that said, let me go back and review the agenda. Myself, I'll generally go over the application and the submission process. We're pleased to have Amy with us. She'll go over some accountability information and program of study and give you some great news about a separate webinar that we're going to host specifically addressing programs of study. I'll also talk with you about some quality assurance tools and resources that can help you in preparation for the submission of your application. And Harriet will come along and instruct you on a general survey that we would like for you to complete regarding today's webinar. General purpose of the call and our goals, generally to give you the information that you will need to submit your request for application, to discuss a little bit about the performance reporting requirement, to answer any questions you may have regarding programmatic, and to provide you with the tools necessary to submit your 2015-2016 application. The topics we will discuss are shown on slide 8, which will include all of our secondary offerings, our post-secondary offering, our Rule and Sparsely POP, our DJJ competitive opportunity, and a little bit about our state correction program. We'll go ahead and go to slide 10. And hopefully for many of you that are listening on the call today, great news, we have not changed a lot in the application process. We are entering our 8th year of a 5-year plan in regards to the Caldy Perkins. And the good news, because we're still in the reauthorization mode, We're simply asking our providers to look back on current year's activity and then determine what enhancements or changes you would like to make as we move forward to the 15-16 program year. Again, our purpose and priorities as outlined in the application to develop more fully academic and career technical ed skills in secondary and post-secondary students who elect to enroll in career and technical education. Great news in regards to funding. Hopefully you all received a memo from Rod last week. The memo was dated April 16th. And we finally received our 2015 allocation from the U.S. Department of Education. And with great news, our allocation was slightly higher than our current year allocation. With that said, Rod released a memo revising the allocations listed in the secondary and post-secondary RFA. The good news, we all got a little increase. So it is our intention to fund our 2015-16 applications using the increased allocation amount. We've updated our RFAs on our website. We submitted a memo from Rod to all of the deans and directors advising you to go back and take a second look at the RFA allocation chart. If for some reason it's overlooked here in the department, when the program managers receive your applications, we will review your application and work with you to ensure that we are aligning with our final 15-16 allocation. So we're getting roughly $62 million. How that breaks out amongst our funding categories, we're standard, pretty much standard in our administrative services, our leadership projects, and aid to district. And that would include our allocations to our locals. Here in the secondary allocation, it defines how the state determines which amount each agency will receive. This particular information is prescribed in law. It's also found in our secondary RFA, but we do extract information from the U.S. Census report, and we're basically doing a 30-70 split, looking at districts' proportionate share of total population of children aged 5 to 17 who reside in the state of Florida. That's the total population per district. And 70% of the allocation is determined based on a district's proportionate share of the number of children in poverty aged 5 to 17 who reside in the state of Florida. If you would like to know specifically about your district's allocation, you are welcome to contact your program manager or Harriet, and we'll be more than happy to share with you the specific data related to your county. As we mentioned about the five-year plans that districts submit to the Florida Department of Education, as well, we must submit our plan to the U.S. Department of Education. So the specific formula related to the distribution of funds for secondary is prescribed in law. As we move to the post-secondary allocation, this one is slightly different. In law, it allows states to request an alternative formula that more defines appropriately how this state determines individuals deemed economically disadvantaged. How did we determine our data elements? As we were developing our Perkins 4 plan, we had a group of practitioners come together from our college sector as well as from our district sector. And together, we collectively determine some common data elements that are defined and mean the same in both delivery systems that define and identify economically disadvantaged individuals. And here on slide 15, you will see the list of our data indicators for post-secondary. Preparing to submit your application. Please download the new 2015-16 application from our website. We have made some slight modifications to the application, updating it with any new rules and regulations prescribed by either the state and or the federal government. So it's very important that you download the most current application. We ask that you go back to your award letter. And the reason why I say your federal award letter, because if you're familiar with last year, you probably talked and negotiated with your program manager here in the department some modifications and updates and changes to your application prior to the finalization of the DOE 200 award notification. It's important that you use that document because it would include all changes and modifications that were agreed upon between the department and your agency. Rather than going back with your original document that you probably have saved as a Word doc, we ask that you really pull the approved award notification and all of those documents and make those necessary changes, and then take a look at how your agency proposed to enhance, change the delivery of career and technical ed in your district or college as we move forward to the 2015-16 year. We've also provided in the back of each application a checklist. That checklist is very, very helpful. It allows you to take a review of all of the documents that will be required in order for your agency to submit a completed application. Again, as it arrives here at the department and our program managers review it, we will notify you if we have some missing items that we must receive. The narrative sections, we suggest that you number your pages, put your package in the order in which it's outlined on the checklist. Make sure your responses are very brief and clear and concise. This allows us an opportunity to review your application in a very timely manner and with minimal corrections. So I'll briefly go over the various sections. Again, at the conclusion of my presentation, I will take the phone off mute and allow for questions. I will, however, recommend that if you have a question, please utilize our great webinar system that you may submit a question via the webinar system, and we will be able to make sure the appropriate person is in the room that can answer your question. This slide, slide 20, also provides for you some additional categories and narrative responses. And specifically on our rule is sparsely pop, there's one special clause where your agency must identify one of the four priority areas that you would focus when using the rule is sparsely pop fund. We also know that within that category, there must be an agreement between the college and the district. How do you propose to serve in those areas? In the application, you have a couple of options. One option would be that the district provides the service in the rural and sparsely cropped area. Select one of the four choices. Or they share it with the college. That's the second option, where the college and the district will share the allocation, and they would come up with a mutually agreed upon amount that they will distribute between each agency, and the agency will then submit their separate application. And the third option would be that in the rural and sparsely cropped area, the college elects to provide services under this allocation, and the district signs an agreement to release the funds. But do remember that even with the rural and sparsely cropped category, you still must submit your secondary application. You still must provide all of the requirements as described here on slide 21, as well as outlined in the rural and sparsely populated area request for application. For the last, I would say, 7 to 10 years, we've had the opportunity to provide additional services in the Department of Juvenile Justice category. This is quite unique because this is our one competitive opportunity using Carl D. Perkins funds. And the whole purpose here is to try and support our DJJ facilities and allowing those students while enrolled in their program to also receive some enhanced and improved career technical ed services. So we have set aside $414,000 in a competitive grant that applicants may apply up to $64,000 per award to support this effort. We will be asking for volunteers to help review the applications. I think the chancellor, if he hasn't already submitted, but you'll see in our monthly announcement as well as a separate announcement from the chancellor that went out earlier, inviting and requesting volunteers to help us participate in the evaluation process to select the best qualified applicants in this category. Because this is a competitive grant, the due date is a firm date. The applications must arrive here at the department on or before May 19th at the close of business. Some highlights from the DJJ competitive grant are typical to those that you may find in our secondary and post-secondary applications. Again, we want an abstract. How do you propose to deliver your service? Identifying the need for the service, and a design. Again, many situations, this particular fund source kind of go hand in glove with the secondary delivery system in the district system. I would emphasize that the eligible applicants in the DJJ process are only district providers. So the district that submit the application should also have a secondary program, and the two, again, work hand in glove. Oftentimes, we talk about the budget, and especially in any application, you'll find that the budget seems to be the most reviewed section in most applications. We do ask that you really take your time and develop very clear, comprehensive budgets. One of the things that we must, as reviewers, attest to is that your expenditures listed in the budget, they're reasonable, allocable, allowable, and necessary. So we do spend a lot of our time reviewing the budget to make sure that the proposed expenditures are in line with your abstract, with your program implementation guide, and that they are necessary in order to fully implement career and technical education. One of the rules that we've often encouraged our applicants to consider is when you're describing a particular line item, use the old rule. By reading that passage, if I were to look at your narrative and read that line item, from that narrative, will I be able to determine the who, what, when, why, where, and quantity of that particular expenditure? We've also provided in our application, I think, a fairly good example on how to write a clear, concise budget narrative line item descriptor. Example of budget items, but not limited to those examples listed here, salary, professional development and training, contract services. I'll spend a little time just emphasizing the contract service category. And we've also provided on our resource page some additional information about how to prepare a very good contract service agreement. So if you or your agency will be contracting services, that means the individual is not employed with your district and or college, then it is considered contract services. And many times our districts and colleges contract out their professional development, contract out some other services. Make sure that you submit the contract service agreement along with your grant application. It's important because we must ensure that your contract agreements are written very clear and concise, that the vendor that you are contracting with is very clear and understand the expectations on what services they must deliver. In the area of equipment, you'll hear me speak a little bit more about equipment later on in the presentation as we talk about the new uniform guidance document. But as regards to the budget narrative form, when you're purchasing equipment or propose to purchase equipment, it's important that you tell us what piece of equipment, what program that equipment will be used. And we have an additional form in our application called a equipment proposed form that gives us an indication of the equipment, the type, estimated cost, and what have you. Also, materials and supplies are common budget items as well as administrative costs. Just a caution on administrative costs. In this particular federal program, it is capped at 5% regardless to the indirect cost rate that your agency currently has approved with our department. It is still capped at 5%. Districts are reminded about the function code as well as object when colleges simply would have their object codes. And I do say to you that our program managers, they have both the Red Book and the College Guide document that we do review your function and object codes to ensure that you're recording the right categories. One of the most common areas for budget amendments or amendments is when an agency lists the incorrect function and or object code, and then they come back after the fact wanting to change it. It's very strict about budget amendments, making sure that you take a good look at your function object codes, and I highly recommend that you work in concert with your finance department because your finance officers are quite familiar with the budget object code and they're familiar with their agency's practice as to the appropriate code for the type of line item expenditure you are proposing. I mentioned earlier about the cap of administrative costs. This slide on slide 27 simply emphasizes that comment, and it kind of gives you a general outline of some of the expenditures that we deem as administrative. Contract service agreement. I spent a little time earlier emphasizing the need to make sure that you submit that document with your application. and that you use the resources that we have available to help you determine whether or not your agency provided and developed a sound, solid contract agreement. The new uniform guidance document. You've probably heard a lot about this. We kind of got started on this over a year ago. Well, as of December 26, 2014, the guidance became official at the federal government level. And basically what it does is it combines and consolidates 8 different reference documents we once used to determine whether or not, as a state agency and as a local provider, you are implementing the federal dollars in accordance to the federal regulations. So you can imagine trying to familiarize yourself with 8 different documents, how sometimes that was confusing. But at the federal level, they deem that it was important to minimize some of the audit findings, streamline the process, and make sure that all agencies were adhering to the same standards and that we were all held accountable at the same level. So imagine you had a district, you had a not-for-profit, you had a government agency guidelines. Now everybody functions and must adhere to the same set of rules and guidelines. And it really, once we really get ourselves wrapped around all of the new requirements as outlined in the uniform guidance, we are excited about it and we anticipate that it's going to minimize some of our audit findings, that we're all playing by the same set of rules. One of the additional highlights that was found in the uniform guidance document, and I will say that the Department of Education, we already had in place a risk assessment process here in the department. Now, the emphasis on doing this risk assessment process on an annual basis is outlined in the new uniform guidance document. There are 2 documents that will be available soon that our districts and colleges and CBOs will be required to submit on an annual basis. The bad news, the form is not available as of today. It's going to be a part of our new Green Book release that will take place soon, and I know it's going to be before July 1 because the new Green Book is effective July 1. I also know that the department will be offering webinars, also face-to-face drive-up workshops around the state where they're going to review the new Green Book and review some of the uniform guidance information, often at the June Finance Officers meeting. I do know that they'll be bringing to that meeting some of the new information regarding the uniform guidance document. We also have several references on our website that you can read that will give you some updates on the uniform guidance document. But one of the emphasis will be on this new form entitled DOE 610. And so our districts and colleges will be required to submit this document. Also, you all familiar with our terms, conditions, and assurance document. I am aware that our districts and colleges agency heads will be required to sign a new terms, conditions, and assurance document. All of these items will be required prior to the official release of the 2015-16 award notification. So as soon as we are aware that the 610 is available, we'll make sure that we do a mass email to let you know the document is there. When the new terms, conditions, and assurances with the Green Book item, when that's up, will make sure that you are aware, because your agency head will have to sign a new terms, conditions, and assurances. But the good news, you'll only have to do it once. Many of your agencies and colleges receive multiple federal funding opportunities from our agency. So as long as our agency, as long as we have at least one new document, I was told that it's going to suffice. I will say that we're probably one of the few federal programs that are out the gate, and our applications are on the website, so you'll probably be submitting your new signed documents through this application, and then the other federal applications will probably be able to use the one that you submit with this application. Equipment purchases. I can probably do a separate one-hour webinar on the enhancements in the uniform guidance document related to equipment. I will not try on this call to go over all of the highlights, but I will say on the next slide, just a few categories in the uniform guidance document that all pertain to equipment. One of the big highlights that I'll just whet your palate with, items that we once viewed as equipment now pretty much will be considered materials or supplies. There's a threshold of $5,000, and I'm going from my memory. I think it's $5,000. That if the item is less than that, then it's basically considered a supply item. So a lot of times when you're purchasing computers and electronic devices, in the eyes of the federal government, they will not be deemed as equipment. However, that does not mean that you're not supposed to keep inventory of those items, that the state, as a state, we have a $1,000 threshold, that we do not want a list of those items in the application or the responsibility at the local level to maintain accurate inventory records of those documents. We still expect that. But it's so important if you are buying some large purchase items, and especially in career and technical ed, we seem to buy a lot of simulators and other items, large price items. I strongly encourage that you read each and every one of the sections highlighted here on slide 32. Conditions of acceptance, again, submitting a signed 100A document from your agency head. In the event that your agency head will not be able to sign that document, it's important that you submit with your application a letter of approval or a letter of authorization authorizing someone other than your superintendent or college president the authority to sign on their behalf. Oftentimes that is a delay. Perhaps at the point that you have completed your application, the president and or superintendent, they're out of the country, out of town, not able to sign. You must submit their authority along with the application. If not, it is not going to be accepted, and that could potentially delay your funding. Make sure that you're using the right and correct application, those TAP numbers that we have listed in the upper right-hand corner of that 100A. I call it our address. It's similar to the U.S. Postal Service that assigns that application to a particular funding category. And we want to make sure that we are submitting the applications in the right funding category. And most importantly, especially if you're submitting in the DJJ competitive grant, it's really important that you use the right documents. Because if not, your application will not be approved and will not be considered as a part of the competitive review process. Submitting the proper number of copies is important because multiple people in the agency must review your application. And oftentimes, if we try and make copies here at the department, you know how copier machines can jam and we can lose or misplace an important document. So we ask our agencies, when you are submitting your application, to make sure that you submit one original and three copies. Let me speak on the original signature for a moment. Because of copying items in the clarity in a black ink when you're copying items, we strongly suggest that you have your agency head, if possible, sign with a blue pen. It is not a requirement, but I can assure you it will make the process go a lot smoother because oftentimes we have to take second, third, and fourth reviews of a signature to ensure that a black ink signature is an original signature. So to avoid that, I strongly suggest that you allow your agency head to use a blue pen so that we can clearly delineate the original signatures from your copies. In regards to the competitive grant for the DJJ, you are required to submit 7 identical copies. And this is real important because we actually use those copies to distribute to our evaluators and to make sure that we have not omitted any of your critical information, we like the customer to provide us with the copies. Here on slide 34, we've provided for you the address by which to mail all of your applications. All applications must go to this address. Please do not send your applications to your program manager, to myself. Our official intake office address is listed here on slide 34, and it's also listed in each of our requests for applications. At this time, I'll pause. We do not have any questions at this time. We have one question. The question, what is the indicator identifier of a sparsely populated area? They wanted to know if I was referring to a special population or sparsely populated. In the request for application for rule as sparsely populated, we have defined the criteria of a county listed as rural and sparsely populated. We use the definition of the state of Florida's READY agency. And I'm looking in the application at this time to refer you to the source that will help you determine how we identify those counties. If any of you can find that particular page in the RFP. If I'm not able to find that particular page in the RFP, if you're in the rural and sparsely populated RFA, it is on my page 12 and 11. And the state of Florida, through the governor's office, identifies particular counties in our state that are considered rural. We use the qualifiers listed in that through that task force and committee. We select those counties, and the whole purpose is to add some additional revenue sources to those counties in order for them to enhance their career and technical-led services. So hopefully I answered the question. At the conclusion of today's webinar, I will open up for questions. And we can further discuss the rural and sparsely populated area. I have received a few other questions. Who signs the DJJ grant as the agency head? The application must be submitted by a school district. DJJ applications may only be submitted by school districts. With that said, it must be a superintendent's sign, signature, and or the superintendent's designee. If the superintendent authorizes another signature, he or she must provide with the application a letter authorizing so. Next question, what office will be announcing the Green Book training this summer? That information will come from our grant management office under the leadership of Janice Brown and under the supervision of Martha Asbury. I do know that they have selected some sites. They've coordinated with some sites to host the five-city tour, and we are waiting for final approval and notification. Again, as soon as I get that, I will make sure that you are aware. Again, I have one final question. For information about our academic program, please confirm that we only need to list any new academic programs that we add this year. You are correct. We are operating under a plan that was submitted by each agency some 8 years ago. With that, each year we ask you to update and add new programs. New programs that you're adding to the Carl D. Perkins funding category. With that said, we simply want those updates and changes to your program delivery service. The question was asked, is it accurate that we would list anything under $5,000 as materials and supplies? I did not bring into the room with me my uniform guidance document, but I will get that during the break while Amy is presenting to you on Perkins accountability. I will go outside of the room and get my official guidance document and clarify the extended category according to the federal government that deemed materials and supplies. That amount did come from memory. I did not have the document in the room with me, but I will go out and get that document and verify that amount. Thank you. At this time, I'll turn it over to Amy Albee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to address some topics around Perkins accountability. The first thing I wanted to go over is, I'm sure as most of you on the phone are aware, we do have specific performance measures. Perkins 4 does require that states develop valid and reliable measures for each core indicator performance in order to accurately measure the performance of Florida's CTE students. And states as well as local programs must report on separate core indicators of performances for secondary and post-secondary students. We have core indicators at the secondary level, as well as the post-secondary level, and that includes our clock hour programs, as well as our college credit programs. Florida has developed a web-based system that allows you to view your local performance in relation to state targets. And I've put on here on our website, on the PowerPoint, which website you can go to check that out. We do call that our Perkins Data Tool that is available right now. So you can go and look at the most recent data that we have, which is 2013-14. Next, on slide 37, I just wanted to list the Perkins performance measures. I'll start with the secondary. I won't read them all off to you. I know what many of you out there were hoping to have was what the targets will be for 15-16, and unfortunately, we do not have that yet. We are in the negotiation process with the U.S. DOE. We have recommended or proposed our targets for 15-16. We have not received word back yet from the U.S. DOE and whether or not those have been accepted. Once they are, we will let you know ASAP. We know that many of you are probably out there anxious to get that information, and we are prepared to get that out to you ASAP as soon as that becomes available. Next, these are just the post-secondary college credit measures. Again, most of them are very similar to what you see at the secondary level. Secondary has some additional measures regarding reading attainment and mathematic attainment. And then also you have the post-secondary clock hour performance measures. Okay, setting local targets for your performance. The state has what we call a LOPL tool, the Local Accountability Performance Level System. And what this tool allows you to do is accept the division's recommended targets, enter the required narrative in order to fill the local application requirement, develop program improvement plans if necessary, download and sign an attestation form on agency letterhead, and local agencies that choose to negotiate a target will be required to work with their program manager should they want to do that. I know we were contacted prior to the call today on that question on what if agencies want to do that. The first thing you'll need to know is that you need to work through your program grant manager. And there is extensive information on what that process entails in our implementation guide. If you have not had the chance to look at the implementation guide, it the 2015-16 version is up, it is available, and it is on our Perkins Resources page. So please go and check that out. But there is an entire section on how to negotiate. But first things first, if you think you want to do that, once you know what your targets are going to be and where you fall, you'll need to work through your program grant manager. The state is currently in the negotiation process with the U.S. DOE, like I said, and information on this, on the targets and completing the web tool, how to access the web tool, will be sent directly to directors and deans through Chancellor Duckworth as soon as it becomes available and essentially as soon as our process of negotiation is complete with the U.S. DOE. Again, as I mentioned just a little bit ago, you can find out extensive information about the process in the implementation guide. And I have a link here where you can find it. I wanted to talk a little bit about local improvement plans. Part of the law states that we, as a state, must annually evaluate the performance of the career or technical education activities of each eligible recipient using our levels of performance. And eligible recipients must develop a program improvement plan performance that does not meet at least 90% of the local agreed upon target. We have been working extensively throughout this past year with those agencies who have not met the target for 3 or more years in the same target on multiple measures. I'm sure some of those agencies are on the phone today, and we will continue to do that process in the upcoming 2015-16 year. We will identify you individually and we will work with you, but we are required by Perkins law to work with agencies once they start struggling and they show that they're having difficulty meeting at least 90% of their target for 3 years or more. So we're going to continue to do that process. You will notice as well, and we began this process last year in the LAPL tool, when you actually go out and complete the LAPL tool, there were separate questions. If you were working on a target and completing your program improvement plan for that target and you had not met 90% for 3 or more years on that target, you were asked additional questions. That's also part of the process we use to identify you, to contact you and work with you individually throughout this past year. I also wanted to touch briefly on technical skill attainment. If you notice back when we looked at our performance measures, each level, secondary, post-secondary clock hour, and post-secondary college credit, all have a technical skill attainment measure. And one of the main ways we assess technical skill attainment is by using your performance on specific technical skill assessments. We did earlier this month, actually late last month, send out information to add certifications to our technical skill attainment inventory. All requests for linkages to that inventory are due by April 30th. We sent out directions as well as the form that you will need to use in order to do that on March 30th, I believe, or March 31st. If you have questions about that, please feel free to contact me. I know that some of you already have. But what we're basically doing for technical skill attainment is we're looking for industry-developed and the program assessments, proprietary company-developed assessment instruments that lead to certification proficiency in one or more of a company's products, for example, Microsoft or Cisco, or they could be third-party developed assessments such as NOFTI, Ask Institute, or BrainBench. And that's just some examples. So again, if you have any questions about the technical skill attainment inventory and how to get an assessment to one of your programs, please let me know. And that memo did go out late last month, and the deadline for requests is April 30th. I also wanted to address what Gloria mentioned a little bit earlier. We will be having a separate program of study webinar. Usually in past years during this webinar, I would touch on programs of study. We realized in the most recent year that it would probably make a lot of sense and be very helpful to many of you if we had a separate webinar. We will be hosting those webinars next week, April 29th and April 30th. We'll have two opportunities. We did have a memo go out on how to register. We are going to be sending out another reminder. The April 29th webinar will take place at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the April 30th will take place at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. If you have any questions about that, please contact myself or Kathy Hammond or Diane Villa Gomez. But again, we will be sending out another reminder with the memo and on how to register for that webinar very shortly. All right. At this time, I guess we will take any questions. If there are any.
All right. We do have a set of questions. Will we submit our request for application without the DOE 600 since it may not be available by the May 19th deadline? Yes. You will submit your application without the 610. The May 19th deadline, by the May 19th deadline, if you're in a competitive process and your application is selected as one of the awarded agencies, we will make sure that prior to issuance of the official DOE award notification, we will have in our possession the DOE 610. Yes, submit your application without it. Will there be a uniform guidance accountability training? Yes. Through Martha Asbury's office, under the leadership of Janice Brown, there is a proposed 5-city face-to-face training, as well as a few webinars that will go over the new uniform guidance training information. I think I've answered this question, but I'll read it again. Is it correct that the official board notification will not be issued until the DOE 610 form and the terms, conditions, and assurance documents are received? That is correct. We would like for you to submit your applications to the department by the scheduled timeline. If the 610 document is not available, we will make sure that you submit your 610 document and it is approved by the department, as well as submit your terms, conditions, and assurance document. As a follow-up to the question regarding materials and supplies and the threshold, I went and picked up my uniform guidance document. And again, this information is quite new to many of us, or all of us, but in regards to computing devices, I'm looking at 200.214. And looking at equipment, which is 200.313. I'm flipping pages. There are multiple references, as we were demonstrated on the slide regarding equipment. It's almost like going to several different sections depending on the type of equipment you are buying and depending on the threshold and amount. I did not want to spend this particular hour specifically talking about equipment and supplies, but I strongly encourage that you download the guidance document and read those several sections that relate to computing devices as well as relate to equipment. And I am reading here that the supplies will vest in the non-federal entity upon acquisition. If there is a residual inventory of useful supplies exceeding $5,000. So we will spend more time offline talking about this. Even with Martha Asbury and her staff, it is my desire to go around the state with them to make sure that if there are any questions, we will have those answered. This is all new to all of us, so we are all learning and trying to train and read up on the documents. So as soon as I know more information about this, I will let you know. But I strongly encourage that you work with your accounting offices and that you each download this document to help all of us as we move forward in our budget, more specifically in the areas of supplies and equipment. At this time, we'll move on. Amy has a few questions. I'll pause and allow Amy to answer the questions. Okay. And again, at the end of this, we will open up for questions through the audio, that you can ask your question through audio as well.
Okay, thank you, Gloria. This is Amy. I received a few questions. I'll just go over them. Are certifications earned via Brain Bench allowed a technical skill attainment list? Yes, they are, as long as they are appropriate for the specific program you're wishing to link it to. So if someone out there has a certification in mind, go ahead, submit it through the process, and we will review it and make sure it aligns with the particular program you're trying to link it with. Okay. We were asked, must an assessment from a technical skill attainment list be used for each OCP, or is a locally developed assessment also? When we think about technical skill attainment, we're not actually looking at OCPs. We're looking at the program level. So what we're trying to do is, for technical skill attainment, is look at your students in your programs who have achieved any type of assessment or certification linked to it on that technical skill attainment inventory. to assess your performance on that particular measure. We don't look at it by OCP. We look at it at the program level. So you do not have to have an assessment for each particular OCP in your program. It would be at the program level, not at the OCP level. It was also asked, would this be to be locally developed assessment? A locally developed assessment would not be appropriate for the TSA list. The next question, do we have a due date for PIPs? We don't have a specific due date for program improvement plans. You will receive more detailed information when the memo goes out regarding the local performance levels. We'll talk about PIPs as well and how you go on the system and actually complete them. Now, I do want to make you all aware that your RFA will not be considered complete until any required PIPs are done. And so you'd want to get that done by June 30th, July 1, when the new grant year starts. But we do not have a hard deadline in place that you must have your PIPs done. We realize that we do not have that LOPL system up yet where you will be going in and actually completing your program improvement plans. So, of course, we appreciate them getting them complete as soon as possible, and it would behoove you to get them done by June 30th. And I just want to let you know we are working as quickly as possible to get that LOPL memo out and to get that system up and running so you can go in there and complete your PIPs. So no, there is not a specific due date, but the sooner the better so your grant will be considered complete. The next question was, is there a webinar on local targets? No, there will not be a separate webinar on local targets. Again, that is, I'm sure many of you out there are aware, we send out an extensive memo, and actually we send it out at the individual level regarding performance levels and on the LOPL system and how to access that. And part of that will inform you of what your local targets may be and how to complete and accept your targets or negotiate them should you wish to. Yes, and also Tara McLarnon and her team will be hosting CTE data trainings. You should have received information on that in the last few days. She will be hosting CTE data trainings around the state beginning in May, and they will address some of that. All right. Thank you, Gloria.
Well, as we go over some of the resource tools, I think between Amy and myself, we've mentioned several of these tools throughout our presentation this morning. We have our resource implementation guide. We have the quality assurance policies and procedure manual. Again, we are in the process of updating that to reflect some of the uniform guidance information. And we have the federal uniform guidance document that I've referenced a number of times during this conversation. We also have the Green Book. It is in the process of being updated. I anticipate any day now hearing the great news that it has been finalized through our legal review, and we're able to release that document. The terms, conditions, and assurances, that's about a 30-page document. Even though your agency head and superintendent only sign one sheet, but it's important to read that. That's sort of like the synopsis of all of the federal and state requirements that our programs are expected to adhere to. In that 30-page document, it's not possible to list everything, but I think the department has done a great job with just including some of the highlights of the terms, conditions, and assurances. And by accepting the money through your agency, what are the expectations in regards to following government guidelines? Okay. Just some highlights when we look at, we do have a compliance team that comes out each year, and we have a risk assessment process that we use to determine which agencies we're going to visit. And the compliance team thought it worthy to kind of add this slide in the presentation today to kind of give you some highlights on some of the common things that they noticed in past year's visits. Again, it deals a lot with the anti-discrimination policy, making sure that that information is posted and readily available at all of your schools and sites. And for some reason, the inventory seems to be a sticky area that agencies are purchasing equipment, but yet when asked for a comprehensive report of all equipment items through the inventory, it's difficult to keep up with it. So I ask that you be mindful of just these three bullets as we move forward into the 15-16 year, and that we continue to offer the technical assistance that you need to operate your program, as well as having our compliance and monitoring team come out and take reviews of your program. At this time, I think I'm going to unmute the phone. I'll get some assistance here from Patsy on how to do that. And we will do some open Q&A, and then we'll close.
Open mode is now disabled.
All right.
In 2002, St. Petersburg College became the first two-year college in Florida to offer four-year baccalaureate degrees, bachelor's degrees, variety of programs, including research, education, and technology.
Gloria, can you hear me?
St. Petersburg College offers dozens of certificates, scores of associate in...
Patient mode is now enabled.
Operator. I need to call the operator to get that call. What we are attempting to do is to call the webinar operator to get the call disconnected from the St. Pete College. Again, if you are listening and you're part of the call, you cannot put the phone on hold because everyone on the call will hear your agency's whole music. So as we contact the state operator to get the call disconnected, I will continue to read some of the questions that we've received via the webinar text. The next question, can we submit a formal draft or proposed contract prior with the application? There are some situations I understand where agencies will not and should not enter into formal contractual agreements with providers without securing their funding. What we have asked that you do, you can write contracts with a contingency statement that contingent on receiving the federal dollar through Carl D. Perkins, this contract can be executed. That's one mechanism that we've used. A second one would be, and because I say this because Carl D. Perkins is an entitlement. It is your agency's money. It's not going to be through competition. The only component of this will be competition is DJJ. So if you're trying to contract out services through DJJ, then yes, you probably would put in a contingency statement and a contingency application for us to review. But all other submissions, secondary, post-secondary, corrections, those are entitlements. By law, those dollars belong to you. We will award those dollars to you contingent that you meet the requirements as outlined by the agency. So I hope I'm able to answer that question. I'm in the process. I'll let Amy receive two questions. I'll let her answer those two, and then I'll bring the operator on the line to help us disconnect any unnecessary background noise. Amy?
Thank you, Gloria. I have a couple additional questions here that were asked. The first is there any information regarding the math academic attainment level given last year's results? Is the state dealing with the situation? Yes, absolutely, we are dealing with the situation. Part of the LOPL memo that we are promising you will come out will include our plan specifically for program improvement plans. We did find through assessment that a majority of our agencies did not meet their target and would have to write a program improvement plan this year because, as you all most likely know, talking about secondary level, went to the end of course exams in algebra, and that changed our performance dramatically. So we had made the decision at this level to not measure against the actual state target, but against the actual state performance. So again, we will explain this further in the memo, but how that will work is if you did not come within 90% of the state's actual performance, you will be required to write a program improvement plan. And so like the other measures, we look at the target. Well, we did not, obviously, as well as the state, meet our target. So we had to write a plan for that. And what we're going to do with the agencies is have you write a plan only if you did not come within 90% of the state's actual performance, not target, but actual performance. We also are currently trying to negotiate, one of the things we're trying to negotiate with the feds is to readjust the current year, 14-15 1S2 target. We realize that it is unlikely that we would come anywhere near it again for 14-15, and we would run into the same scenario next year. So we are working to amend that target and renegotiate. We will inform you of that once we get information from the USDOE. So yes, we are working on it. And those are some of the that's the information that I have at this time. We're hoping that we can amend the measure. And also, again, you think about your program improvement plans, think about the state's actual performance, not its actual target. That's how we will be measuring you.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I have one last question that I received. It says, will a list of all new and current program SIPs be required with the application? I think this is something Gloria touched on earlier, and the answer is yes. If you have any new programs that you'll be offering, you should update them on your RFA.
Thank you, Amy. At this time, I'm going to unmute the line, and then if we still have some background noise, I will include the operator.
Patient mode is now disabled.
Hi, Gloria. Ms. Brown? Hello, Gloria, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
This is Sam Stolnick here in Madison County. For districts that have two or more DJJ facilities, is it possible for them to submit an application for each facility, or is it just one application for the district?
One application per district.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Hello, this is Chris from Hillsborough County.
Yes, hi,
question
Chris.
For you regarding the threshold for equipment. So currently when we submit the budget, we use, for example, the 641 and 642 object, either being over $1,000 or under $1,000. So are we continuing to do our budget like that, or is $5,000 something we need to be considering?
Yes, you're going to continue to do your budget like that, but what the federal government has informed us, computing devices, things that you typically buy that we once would view as equipment are no longer equipment. They are called materials and supplies. So you will label those items materials and supplies.
Hello?
Yes.
This is Joe Entwistle calling from Washington County. In the past, the projects for DJJ were by facility, not by county school district. Is that a change this year?
Okay, Jill, can I address the question before from Hillsboro, and then I'll come right back to you. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right. Going back to the equipment question, what we're saying is things that we typically thought in our heads would be equipment, such as computing devices, depending on the price, will no longer be computing devices. They're going to be labeled materials and supplies. Did that answer your question?
So just to clarify, so right now we use a different object for if we're buying furniture and equipment versus if we're buying computers, whether they're under $1,000, you know, under or over $1,000. So what you're saying is we're buying a computer that's $1,500, then we're supposed to classify that as a supply?
That is what is defined here in the federal regs, that it now considers materials and supplies. Now you want to work with your finance officer because there are different types. There's capital, non-capital, general, special equipment. So you really must go to your finance comptroller, and they must advise that.
So, and right now we fill out that separate equipment list for anything over $1,000. So will we still be including these on that separate equipment list where we give the details?
Yes. Please continue to do that.
For anything over $1,000?
Yes.
Thank you.
Now, can I come back to the question regarding the DJJ and multiple facilities? Will you please ask the question again?
Yes, in the past, the grants were awarded one per facility. And many districts have many facilities in them, and I just heard you say it was going to be limited to one per district, one per county. Is that a change?
It is on page one. Correction, it's one per site. You are correct. It is one per site. Basically, it's found on page one of the RFP.
Right, so that one man who just answered earlier, somebody should tell him if he's not still on.
I will make sure that he gets the right information. It's one per site. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. I've already
got it,
too, so that's why I was happy.
How do I want to say this?
Hey, thanks for the clarification. I got the update.
Thank you. Do note that please place your phones on mute. We hear multiple background conversations. So if you would place your phone on mute at the local level and then unmute it if you have a question.
Gloria, this is Galen Thomas at South Florida State College. I have a question regarding the equipment again.
Yes.
I may have misunderstood what the gentleman was referring to or what you were referring to, but it was my understanding that the projected equipment purchases form is where this $5,000 limit is reflected. Is that correct?
Software.
Let me repeat it. The projected equipment form is for all equipment items over $1,000. I'm going to have someone pull the form for me. I don't have the form in front of me, but let me have the form in front of me. What we were saying to you is that we have federal laws, and we have state laws. We have federal laws, and we have state laws. The state of Florida says $1,000, and that's what we're sticking with. $1,000. $1,000.
Okay. So what does the $5,000, how does that impact us? It doesn't? On our applications, that doesn't impact us.
It impacts you in how you categorize your items. How do you, what line item, what budget line item?
What function?
Yes.
Okay. All righty. Thank you.
If you look at
just to clarify, so what you're saying is, this is Chris from Hillsboro. On the equipment form over $1,000, where we put the object, we might be putting 5-10 supplies as the object.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
But our budget offices won't allow us to report it that way.
Your budget officer will be changing because of the new uniform guidance document. Your comptrollers are aware of the new regulations. It's all new. So
okay.
We're all looking at things differently as we proceed with the July 1 funding. We're moving to a new way of doing it. So you must talk to your comptroller's office to make sure that you are labeling and putting the right line items for any equipment purchases. 1,000, under 1,000, over 1,000, over 5,000. You must work with it this time around.
I got you. Thank you.
Thank you for holding. A representative of St. Petersburg College will be with you shortly. Did you know that St. Petersburg College is the oldest two-year college in the state? The college was founded in 1927.
We're going to figure out who's on the call from St. Pete's College. I can tell you that.
In 2002, St. Petersburg College became the first two-year college in Florida to offer four-year baccalaureate degrees. The college offers bachelor's degrees in a variety of programs, including nursing, education, and technology management. Petersburg College offers dozens of certificates, scores of associate in science degrees, and hundreds of majors through its associate in arts degree.
We are awesome. Okay, great. The state operator has disconnected that individual from the call. I strongly encourage you to place your phones on mute by pressing star 6. Do not use your agency hold button. All right. Are there any additional questions for Amy or myself regarding the application process? And do remember, you may call me or call your program manager at any time in this process. The only applications that we cannot discuss with you will be the DJJ applications because they're competitive. But all other applications are RFAs. We can help you as you prepare to submit that information. At this time, if we do not have any additional questions, I'm going to ask Harriet to close us out and to give you some important information about the survey.
This is Harriet Abrams, Director of Administration. Your feedback regarding the webinar is very important for us. Therefore, I welcome and strongly encourage you to complete the brief survey that you can access with the link on the screen. Thank you again for participating in this webinar.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you, Amy. And thank you to all of you who participated. If you have any questions, please do not hesitate to call. Wonderful day.